Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in to what we're calling Halloween, because we will just not let a joke die.
Yeah, even an accidental joke that stems from just like a momentary mispronunciation of a very common word.
Well, it's probably my Appalachian roots linguistically popping out my accent. But I am thrilled to be joined with you guys again, Noel Nyarlathotep Brown and Casey super producer Casey Cthulhu Pegram.
Oh, hell yes.
Guys, I went. We usually try to take a little a quick break between episodes of recording something straight through, and I literally ran away and like picked up one of my H.P. Lovecraft books, and I was like, I know there's something here. So I apologize for being late. I tried to Noel. I really wanted to nail that pronunciation for you, Nyarlathotep.
Yeah. I got one for you. How about this? Ben, the void stares back, Bolin.
Ooh, thank you. I love it and I agree. Mm-hmm. And so we're in merry spirits as we explore
some not so merry spirits.
Some not so merry spirits. As we teased in part one, this is the second half of the Greenbrier Ghost, in which we encounter some stunning revelations, some scandalous plot twists. I don't know. What do you think, man? Would it be good for us to give like just a brief summary of episode one?
Oh, I think that's always helpful, Ben. So we've got an unexplained death or a poorly explained death. Mm-hmm. Let's say the local physician, Dr. Knapp, sounds like a made-up character, blamed it on the everlasting faint, aka a heart attack. But this is the woman in question who passed away, one Elva Zona Shu, maiden name Heaster, was discovered in a ramshackle pile at the bottom of the stairs in the home where she was living with her ne'er-do-well husband, Erasmus, if we were going to give him a nickname, the Irascible, Shu, a.k.a. Trout, which is mainly what we've been referring to him as, although we really like the name Erasmus. He very suspiciously had left the house, gone to visit a neighborhood, Auntie Martha, I believe, mm-hmm. And then had her young son go and fetch some eggs from his wife, only to discover her decrepit body, dead, her corpse at the bottom of the stairs. There was an autopsy performed quite haphazardly, if I do say so myself, by said local physician and coroner, Dr. Knapp. And Trout very conspicuously was not cool with him examining the neck parts. Flash forward to the funeral back in Zona's hometown on the other side of Greenbrier County, where Trout even more conspicuously and awkwardly sticks close to the casket and makes sure that her neck parts are covered up by going as far as propping her head up, I believe we referred to it as death becomes her style, in the casket, and made sure no one got a good look at her neck. What happens next, Ben?
Well, then everybody is being pathologically polite, as we said, and letting this guy do his weird neck stuff to his wife's corpse, and no one's raising a stink about it except for Zona's mother, Mary Jane Heaster. She never liked Erasmus. She also found him sketchy. Is what I would call a sketch artist, because mm-hmm. I am a fan of terrible euphemisms. And she then experienced a series of visions. For 4 nights, she was visited by what she believed to be the ghost of her daughter after extensive praying. And her daughter not only said that she did not die of a heart attack, she said that her husband had murdered her. Murder most foul. And she specifically said, this is where it happened. This is how he broke my neck. This is where he broke my neck. This is what the view looked like out of our house. And Mary Jane had all these details, she brought them to the town prosecutor, one Mr. Preston. Mr. Preston, we don't know whether he believed in ghosts, but through sheer tenacity, Mary Jane was able to persuade him to start asking questions. He finds out about this weird neck stuff. He gets the doctor in a very like lovable kind of absent-minded professor way.
Mm-hmm. Well, shucks, you know, it was a little odd that that this guy named Trout was against me examining the neck area of his dead wife. But I just chalked it up to grief, and I just figured I didn't want to ask too many questions. I mean, the man's grieving. He's shedding tears. He's a grown man. I didn't want to push him over the edge, you know? I mean, have a little compassion, why don't you? But yeah, he goes back to say, okay, well, now that you mentioned it, that was a little odd. So they exhume the body for a second autopsy, at which point they find some pretty conspicuous markings around the neck, a crushed windpipe, finger bruises around the neck, all things that point to Trout as perhaps being the perpetrator of what is now looked at not as a case of the horribles, or what do they call it?
The everlasting faint.
The everlasting faint, but rather a murder.
And the plot continues to thicken just like cornstarch, I guess. I'm not a cornstarch doctor or whatever, but it looks like murder rather than an unfortunate heart attack. And what's more, the markings on the body correlate almost precisely, according to the papers of the time, with the information that Mary Jane claims to have received from her daughter's ghost. However, there and then Trout says some ridiculously sketchy stuff about this, kind of like when O.J. Simpson published a book called If I Had Done It, and this gives Preston, the prosecutor, even more of an off feeling. But at this point, people in town are saying, well, it could have been Shu, but how did Mary Jane have all this information? What if she is not only making up this ghost story, but what if she is the murderer and framing her son-in-law? That's where our stage is set. Back to our intrepid prosecutor. He's doing some detective work. He's got a Sherlock Holmes hat on. Whatever. Do we know the specific name for that kind of hat?
Yeah, it's called a deerstalker. Not sure why I know that, but for some reason I do. And yeah, it's true. He keeps digging. He keeps digging and looking into Shu's past, because this guy is now really looking good as suspect number one. And he finds out that Shu's been married twice before.
Scandal.
Yeah, scandal indeed. And according to the record, the first marriage ended in a divorce when Shu was sent to prison for stealing a horse. It's what they call a horse divorce. It's what happens. You steal a horse, automatic divorce.
I thought it was a de-horse. Maybe that's what they just call it in Tennessee.
Yeah, might be right. It's, you know, there's different colloquialisms all over this grand country of ours. Language is a living thing, as you say. But that wife later told the cops that Shu was, in fact, an awful, violent, aggressive, angry man who beat her quite frequently when they were married. The second marriage that he entered into ended after only 8 months with, oh my gosh, surprise, surprise, the mysterious death of that wife.
Yeah, Lucy Ann Tritt Shu had lived with her husband for a little less than 8 months, and she died under suspicious circumstances. Check this out. The first wife was supposed to have passed away from a broken neck when she fell from a haystack. The second wife apparently died while helping Trout repair a chimney. He was on top of the chimney. His wife was putting rocks in a basket with a rope attached so they could, you know,
yeah, like a counterweight or something.
Yeah, do a pulley thing up to the top. And as the basket was drawn up, it turned over and dropped the rock on the head of his wife. That's the explanation for the second wife, but those are still mysterious circumstances because, you see, gentlemen, some people said that this second wife, Lucy, was pregnant at the time of her death, and was still to this day, you'll hear people say she fell through ice, others say the rocks hit her on the head, and some say it was poison.
Oh my gosh. And let's just really quickly, you know, the initial digging revealed only that the first wife, the first marriage ended in divorce, but there are these differing stories of these other potential deaths and these potential super sketchy deaths. And, you know, I mean, it is circumstantial, but it is a smoke fire type situation. And it certainly, at the very least, points to Shu Trout being a pretty awful guy. So he's got this information now, and we also have an account that while he was in prison between those marriages for the horse theft, that he bragged about this idea that he was going to marry seven women in his lifetime.
Weird flex, weird goal, to each their own, I guess, but There's definitely that's the kind of statement that definitely leaves some questions, right? Because the U.S. at this time has laws against what's known as bigamy. Bigamy is the practice of going to marry someone when you are, in fact, still married to someone else. So he would have been a sextuple bigamist, I guess?
It would seem so. And that paired with his previous statement when presented with the plans to exhume his third dead wife's body, the apparition in question. By the way, my daughter the other day, she likes this anime and it's about ghosts. And she was like, "Dad, you know what an operation is?" And I go, "Well, you mean like a ghost?" She goes, "Yeah, an operation." I'm like, "I think you mean apparition." She goes, nope, it's definitely an operation. I read it on the subtitles right there on the screen. And I had to like break it to her like, nope, you got that one wrong. And she hasn't spoken to me since. But yeah, today's apparition in question. So between all of those details, even though they're circumstantial, and Shu's statement of if I, you know, O.J. Simpson-like statement of, well, you're going to arrest me, but you're not going to be able to prove that I did it. It was enough for this prosecutor to bring him to trial. And there was a grand jury assembled, and the trial began in June.
Lewisburg, West Virginia, June 30th, 1897. Trout hires two defense lawyers, William Riechler and James Gardner, to be his representatives in a court of law. James Gardner, by the way, is the very first black lawyer to practice in a circuit court in the state of West Virginia. At the trial, here's the tricky thing. There's not a ton of hard evidence available. Yes, Elva Zona's neck is broken, and there are hand marks, for sure. But as we pointed out, forensic science then is not what it is today. And yes, Trout did brag, "They will not be able to prove I did it," which is a quote, but that doesn't get you beyond reasonable doubt in a murder case. You know what I mean? So the defense calls Mary Jane to the stand, and the defense attorney asks her to describe her visits from this operation, this ghost. And she does. This was the defense, most likely this was the defense's attempt to attack her credibility, right? To make her seem like a crazy, grieving parent. But she stuck to her guns, and later a full transcript of this conversation was published by a newspaper called the Monroe Watchman. We teased this a little bit. We're not going to give you the whole transcript, but we think it might be suitable for a bit of a, what do you think, Noel? A dramatic reenactment?
Yeah, I think so. And listen, any Southern drawl accents we do, we come honestly by. We're from the South. Ben, you're from Tennessee. You know, we're not making fun of anybody. They're just fun to do. Can we all agree on that? That we're not trying to make fun of anybody's culture or background here?
You want to rock, paper, scissors for the attorney?
Absolutely.
Okay, it's 1, 2, 3, shoot, right?
1, 2, 3, shoot. Let's eyes closed so there's no lag, because there's a lag on the video.
Yeah. Okay, Casey, you're our impartial witness, and it's deathmatch, so the winner is the attorney. Ready?
Okay, great.
All right.
1, 2, 3, shoot. Eyes open.
Both were below the camera line. I think I see paper and says, all right.
Okay, so Noel's, you're the attorney, it. Noel.
I'm a scissor. Okay, I'm the
attorney. I trust that you didn't cheat.
I never, never.
That's a quister kind of move. All right.
I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't stoop to that level.
Here we go. Right, Casey, hit the music.
Mrs. Heaster, are you positively sure that these visits are not for dreams?
Why, yes, sir. It was not a dream. I don't dream when I am wide awake, to be sure, and I know I saw her right there with me.
Are you or are you not considerably superstitious?
Well, no, sir, I am not. I was never that way before, and I am not now.
But do you believe in the scriptures?
Well, yes, sir. I have no reason not to believe it.
And do you believe the scriptures contain the word of God and his son?
Yes, sir, I do. Don't you believe it?
Now, I would like it, if I could, to get you to say that these were for dreams and not for visions or appearances of your daughter in flesh and blood.
I am not going to say that, for I am not going to lie.
And scene.
And scene.
All right.
Casey, could you just out of pity throw us an applause cue? Because I know our fellow ridiculous historians aren't going to do it.
That is no pity applause. Those accents were something else.
Oh, thanks, Brian.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right.
I'll take that backhanded compliment all day long.
You're on thin ice, my friend. I can't believe I gave you Cthulhu. Gosh.
Bless your hearts.
Oh, okay. No. All right. You know, moving on. We're working live. Here's the deal. Many of the people in town, maybe not all 12 jury members, but many people in the town believed Heaster's story. She seemed sincere. She did not seem as though she had some sort of ulterior motive to murder her own daughter. She certainly wasn't getting any money out of this. And to be honest, Erasmus didn't really do himself any favors when he took the stand. He was just kind of like rambling like a crazy guy who accidentally walked onto the TED Talk stage. He was saying stuff to the jury, like interrupting the lawyers and saying like, look into my face and then you tell me if I'm guilty, which is the worst thing to say.
Yeah, especially if you're like a super guilty looking dude. Like, I'd be like, look away from my face, but pay me no mind, you know?
Yeah.
It's a very interesting scene. And not to mention, this didn't really come up, but this is just my two cents. You know, this was an elderly lady, and these were the types of injuries that were clearly inflicted by hand, by very strong hands, like animalistically strong hands, perhaps the hands of a trout. I know trout don't have hands, but a guy with a nickname Trout does.
Yep. And because the jury had no hard evidence to consider, just circumstantial stuff, and then, of course, what appears to be the testimony of a woman who received information from a ghost, they're left with kind of feeling out the vibe. You know what I mean? Going with their guts. And this guy makes a terrible first impression on them. So the judge said, you know, there's no middle ground for the jury to take. The verdict inevitably and logically must be for murder in the first degree or for an acquittal. No other choices, no manslaughter, nothing like that. The jury deliberates, but they don't go 12 Angry Men style. They're only deliberating for maybe an hour and change.
Surprised it took them that long.
Yeah, what do they find?
Well, I mean, yeah, they convicted the guy. I mean, I just can't imagine what else they would have done when presented with especially such unsympathetic testimony from the man himself.
Look at my face.
Look at my
you
face.
Tell me.
this is the face of a child of God, right? No. Yeah, but they sentenced him to life. And it turns out that's exactly what they took, as they say in The Shawshank Redemption. Only in this case, it means that he died pretty quickly in prison of an undetermined malady. But as we know, in the time, the spring of 1900, something we can relate to, there were quite a few epidemics running around. Measles and pneumonia were absolutely ripping through this particular prison, the Moundsville State Prison. And he had no one to come and claim his body. And this is all from actually the official website of Greenbrier, West Virginia.
And so now a question, a very Halloween-y question for everyone in the crowd, true believers and skeptics alike. Was it a ghostly visitation, or was it simply mother's intuition that uncovered the murderer? Mary Jane Haster lived long after Trout Erasmus has passed away. She lived until 1916. She never changed her story about Elvazona's ghost. Maybe it was her story that swayed the jury and won the case. Maybe it wasn't. And as they say in a great Mental Floss article about this, maybe her daughter did speak to her from beyond the grave. Maybe it was all in Mary Jane's head, or maybe, just maybe, she had arrived at the information through mundane means and chose to frame it in this otherworldly lie to get more eyes on it, to get more attention. But no matter what, if she did not have the ghost story, she would not have gone to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor never would have put those pieces together. And it's quite possible that Shu would have been on spouse number four pretty soon.
The shoe would have been on the other spouse.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind. I was just the shoe on the other foot. Forget it. Forget I said anything.
No, I thought it worked. It worked.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And so that's essentially the end of, you know, the main part of the story, but it actually becomes a little bit more of a legend, which I love the idea of the legend of Zona. Makes me think of The Legend of Zelda, of course. But it's mainly referred to in folklore and the lore, I guess, of the area of Appalachia as the Greenbrier Ghost. And it has taken on sort of a life of its own over the years. It's told on a lot of like ghost tours, which we know well, even around here in Atlanta, but especially in more haunted rural type places or like New Orleans, you might think of. But there is actually a West Virginia microbrewery named Zona's Revenge, which is it's in her honor, and it is a Weissbier, which is a very nice, very drinkable, summery kind of beer. If you haven't had a Weiss beer, I highly recommend it. And Ben, I know you're a fan of this. Jenna Pearson, the comic, appears on an episode of Drunk History and tells the drunk version of this story. And it has been adapted into quite a few stage plays. There's even a musical, which I want to hear all about, The Greenbrier Ghost, the musical, written by somebody named Clay Zambo, which is a fabulous name from the National.
Zambo, yeah.
You know Clay Zambo?
No.
Ah, shit. Okay. Well, music and lyrics by Clay Zambo. And it was apparently there's a, you can read about it on newplayexchange.org. But it did seem to capture people's imagination. I'm surprised that we haven't seen it as a podcast yet. I mean, I guess, you know, we are doing it as a podcast, but I mean, as like a spooky Halloween fiction podcast, like 13 Days of Halloween from iHeartRadio, featuring the original works of Ben Bolin and a slew of other incredible writers, most of which are from right here in the Atlanta area.
Made by our very own ride or die compatriots, Matt Frederick, and the one and only Alex Williams, who composed this this banging track. Well, don't worry, Alex. I know you listen to this show entirely for the part where we thank you at the end. We'll make sure to do it. There is still a little bit of an epilogue here, because if you are a fan of road trips or you live in the area and you want to see the living history, go to US 60. And between Sam Black Church and the I-64 entrance ramp, you can pull over and see a state highway marker that sums up this story, saying the following: interred in a nearby cemetery is Zona Haster Shu. Her death in 1897 was presumed natural until her spirit appeared to her mother to describe how she was killed by her husband, Edward. Erasmus introduced himself as Edward, by the way. We made the editorial choice to go with the much cooler name. And apologies to the Edwards in the crowd. You can go by Erasmus if you want, man. The world is yours. Carpe diem. Autopsy on the exhumed body verified the apparition's account. Edward, found guilty of murder, was sentenced to state prison. It's strange because, you know, later investigators like Katie Letcher Lyle have made some pretty compelling arguments that Mary Jane was leaning into a supernatural angle to get leverage and get her somewhat suspicious neighbors to support her cause. And, you know, whether or not you believe in ghosts, the fact of the matter is it worked and justice was served. And if you look at the evidence we have now, 124 years later or so, he did it. Like he killed her, right? We can agree. That's pretty conclusive.
Oh, yeah. With just about 0% uncertainty, we can conclude that. But here's the thing. We do have a precedent that Zona's mother likely would have been aware of for perhaps shaping her telling of this ghost story in a way that might sway a jury, right? When Zona's life was taken, one of the places that her death was first reported, we mentioned this, was in a publication called the Greenbrier Independent on page 3 in January, specifically the 28th of 1897. And it was only briefly mentioned, but this is how it went. Mrs. E.Z. Shu, wife of E.S. Shu, died at her home in the Richlands, this county, on Sunday last, the 24th. Aged 22nd years, Mrs. Shu was a daughter of Mr. Hedges Heister of Meadow Bluff District. Mr. Shu formerly lived in Pocahontas County. But on the very front page of this publication was a headline, a ghost story. And it went on to talk about a case in Australia that was happening around the same time. Ben, would you like to do a bit of this reading here?
Sure. And we'll do this in perhaps the accent of the reporter. One of the most famous murder cases in Australia was discovered by the ghost of a murdered man sitting on the rail of a dam. That's Australian for hearse pond, into which his body had been thrown. Numberless people saw it, and the crime was duly brought home. Years after, a dying man, making his confession, said that he invented the ghost. He witnessed the crime, but was threatened with death if he divulged it as he wished to, and the only way he saw out of the impasse was to affect to see the ghost where the body would be found. As soon as he started the story, such is the power of nervousness that numerous other people began to see it, until its fame reached such dimensions that a search was made and the body found, and the murderers brought to justice. That's interesting, right? Because we know Mary Jane is probably reading this paper.
Of course she is, yeah. It was the front page. She wouldn't have been able to miss it.
And it's also the paper that contains the announcement of her daughter's tragic passing.
Yes, exactly so.
And so maybe, just maybe, and this is, to be fair, this is speculation on our part and the part of other people who may share this belief, but just maybe Mary Jane saw this and hatched a plan because she thought this would help galvanize local law enforcement and authorities to do a better job investigating this. Or maybe it was unconscious on her part because she's in a very traumatized mental state at this time. So it's quite possible, for example, that she read it and didn't consciously register it, and it just affected what she believed she experienced later. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah.
Could have been a ghost.
You know, I it's interesting that this is hard to ignore, don't you think, Ben? The coincidence here of this other story literally setting a precedent for, you know, concocting a ghost story to make sure that someone's killer actually gets convicted in the same exact publication that the announcement of her daughter's death, where she definitely would have had eyes on that. Her being a bit of a shrewd woman, clearly, and having known this gentleman was a bit of a no good Nick, and also knowing that he was being super sketchy around the neck. And I guess it being a quite patriarchal society, mm-hmm. the mother would have had very little ability to do anything about that, you know, just to call him out in public, you know, in that way. So she would have had to go about it in a bit of a more circuitous path.
Yeah. And I think that's an excellent point. I mean, it reminds me of some of the other stuff we've done about the socioeconomic context of exorcisms, right?
I was thinking the very same thing, Ben. Yep.
yeah. So and that's something you can check out on the other show. We do Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. I think there's a lot to be said there. We know that this is not necessarily the only case where people feel a murder has been revealed by a ghost, but at this time, even now in 2020, the case of the Greenbrier ghost remains the only time in U.S. history that a murder conviction has been determined by a source purportedly beyond the grave.
Hear, hear. What do you think, Ben? Have we done justice to this two-parter yet? Should we keep going?
I think we've done it. I think we have successfully made a two-parter on purpose, which is big for us.
Yeah.
I want there to be ghosts, man. But this is such a great story that I propose we pass the torch to our fellow ridiculous historians to tell us some of their favorite ghost stories. What do you think?
I agree. Ben, do you have any? Have you had any brushes with the afterworld?
I have. There are things I can't explain, but I think automatically calling those spirits or ghosts is kind of explaining them, you know, when I don't have the evidence. I will say my family believes in a lot of that stuff historically.
Yeah, and my ex-wife and you know, one of my best friends, Casey, is very much a spiritual person and is into like Wicca and a lot of that stuff and stuff that I'm not. I wouldn't like poo-poo or anything, but it's not necessarily my wheelhouse or stuff that I fully understand or believe, I would say. But I would never judge anybody else for their beliefs or in whatever they might be. I think I've told the story on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know before, and I'll tell the very abbreviated version of it. I had the closest thing that I would call a brush with the supernatural when I was late high school. The girl that I dated for a really long time was older than me, and she was in college, and I would visit her after class, and she'd wait for me in her car, and it was really cold one day, and I walked up to her car, and she was sitting in the car, and she looked like visibly shaken, and she was kind of like crying, and I said, "What's going on?" And she blew on the inside of her windshield, and this signature appeared. And it was the signature of her friend, our friend, but her best friend, Missa, who had died in a car accident about 3 weeks prior. And I just got hit with the most, you know, intense sense of I am experiencing a ghostly apparition, a ghostly vision. That is what this is. No question about it. And I was shaken. I was moved to tears. And I really didn't know what to think, and I, other than that's what this is. And then a little time passed, and I thought about it, and it's like, you know, it's the kind of thing young girls do. They write their names on the inside of, you know, foggy windshields with their fingers, and if it had been recent enough, you got oils on your fingers that would cause it to leave a mark that you could, you know, blow on, and you could see that kind of return. But I swear to God, man, I felt the spirit. I really did. And then I sort of explained it away, which is almost sad, but I couldn't deny that part of the story either.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in the spirit of quid pro quo, I'll give you a story as well. But first, Casey, do you have, now that we're gathered around our Zoom campfire, do you have something to tell us as the flames throw orange shadows and shades across your face?
No, I have to be kind of disappointing here, although I do remember playing like that game Bloody Mary as a kid at a friend's house.
Oh, God, why would you do that?
And and really, really psyching ourselves up. And you know, it was like an old house, and it was full of weird noises and stuff. So, you know, we heard stuff, felt like we saw stuff because it was just candlelight. But I'm pretty sure we were just kind of highly suggestible, maybe. But yeah, that's about the closest I can recall from the ghostly realm.
So in the spirit of fairness, then I will say, without shouting out specific family members, there is a little bit of a stereotype persistent in days of yore around my ancestors, Melungeons, usually like allegations of witchcraft, or they have secret hoards of riches that they got through magical means, dark magical means. And keep in mind that riches in like 1700s, 1800s, rural Tennessee are not what you would consider riches in New York City. You know what I mean? But for most of my life growing up, I've heard stories that hinge on things more like precognitive dreams or clairvoyance from my family. And in my lifetime, I have seen things that I cannot as I try as I might, I cannot explain through mundane means. To give a light note, we used to travel all the time, right? In the days before the pandemic. And I can't wait to get on the road again with you guys. But on a lighter note, one of my favorite pranks in hotels, I will tell you, I hope you guys don't hate me after this because it may be a little mean for some folks in the crowd, but it's so fun. I used to take shaving cream and you write a message on the mirror, a cryptic message, and then you clean it off. And then when someone turns on the shower and the room fogs up, then that message will be visible because the condensation won't work the same way on the part where the shaving cream was. So I used to write stuff like, "They're coming." And then erase it.
Do you think spooky ghosts ever haunt via shaving cream? I would love that. That would be cool.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I thought it was a fun little plot twist, spice up people's lives. You know what I mean? It's a little bit of light anarchy, a little bit of subgenius stuff there. But it's fun. It's like making fake lost posters. I used to make missing posters for boomerangs and stuff like that.
That's pretty funny, Ben. That's very Dada. I like that very much. Hey, is this the last spooky episode of the season for us? Am I getting the calendar muddled up?
Yeah, I think you're right, Noel. This will wrap it up for our Halloween extravaganza.
No, good come on. Save.
But can we just keep doing it?
I want to. I mean, it feels sometimes like it's always Halloween in America now.
I feel like November's sort of Halloween-y a little bit, you know?
Yeah. It's happy Halloween. You know, we made up our own spin on the holiday.
Yeah. Halloween is just 2 months of Halloween.
There we go.
Because we definitely have more spooky stories in the research materials that we could talk about. I don't know. We don't have to limit ourselves.
We don't. You know, maybe the real Halloween was the friends we made along the way. Which is how you always end improv shows if you just need to get out of the scene.
That's true. It's a very good point.
But the yeah, we've had a blast with this, and you could say it's not Halloween if it's every day of the year, but we hope that you have enjoyed this, and hey, just because this is coming out toward the end of the season, don't feel like you can't send us nicknames. Don't feel like they have to be spooky. Send us cool nicknames. Shout out to Melissa N. over on Ridiculous Historians, who gave me the nickname Ben Boo Bolin, which I'm frankly surprised. Wait, did you think of that one already, Noel?
I was the very first one. It's the most go-to, easy, low-hanging Halloween fruit that ever could be. But thanks for the callback. Full circle, my friend. Full circle.
A happy Halloween, everybody. Big thank you to Alex Williams. Big thank you to Christopher Hasiotis. Big thank you to you, super producer Casey Pegram.
Yeah. Big whatever, John. I'm fading, guys. It's 6 o'clock here. It's Friday, and I am ready to flee.
I'm kind of punchy too, man. I'm kind of punchy too.
All right, let's leave it at that. We'll see you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.